Welcome, 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 and of course, welcome. Welcome to the CDOT Show, presented by Inquirer Sports, sponsored by Cincy Shirts, where you can always save 20% off your order by entering promo code CDOT at checkout. I am your host, Josh Sneed, joined by my affable co-host, Trent Rosecrans. How are you, sir?
Affable. Quite. Affable. Quite affable.
Describe that word.
Yeah, define it.
What's the definition of that word?
It means everybody likes you.
Oh. No, then that's not me.
That's I'm not just it. Misnomer.
Well, there's the 30 seconds in train wreck that you always seem to cause with the flow of the show. Always good to see you, Trent. How's things?
Fantastic. We're here with George Foster.
We are
that's
here.
Your job.
I'm not here.
How about that?
Listen to that.
What's that?
He might be the first person on this show to have gotten an ovation before he said a word.
Yeah, I planted them out there. I paid them off. Am I on? I'm on?
Yeah, oh, you're on.
We're on. All right.
We are joined by Reds legend, George Foster, ladies and gentlemen. Let's clap again, because he deserves it again. Even though he constantly tells me how I'm not funny,
that's all right. Keep you humble.
That's all right. I can take it. I can take it from you. You're one of those guys where you whatever you say to me, I'm like, oh, George, because I just want to hang out with you more.
I say it with a smile, man.
I know. You say it in jest, and it's pretty surreal for me, being a lifelong Reds fan, to have any sort of conversation with you where you would joke around with me. So I always take it as quite the honor to talk to you and to see you and Vicky. George, of course, a member of the... arguably, and the greatest team ever assembled, the 1977 National League MVP. And my first question for you, the first time I got the chance to meet you was at Marty Brenneman's golf outing. And before we tee off at the golf outing, they always go down the list of celebrities and they sort of give their credits. And I usually spend that time watching the group who I've been assigned as their celebrity figure out in disappointment that I've become their celebrity. But whenever Marty reads off your credits, he always prefaces it with, you had the greatest single season he's ever seen by a player in 1977. And considering the baseball people he's been around and as long as he's been around the game, that has to always feel pretty good to hear somebody say that about you.
Well, not just somebody, Marty Brenneman, because, you know, here's a guy that he's going to say what he feels on his mind, and it's always great to hear it from him, and I know that it really means something coming from him, because, like you said, he's seen a lot of Major League Baseball players, and for him to say that's the greatest season he's ever seen, the only drawback for me is that, I mean, personally it was great, but collectively we ended up in second place. That year I wanted to just play all year. I wanted to go all around the world, let people know what I can do. But as it turned out, the season was over. It seemed like it was a short season. I guess for most of the pitchers, it seemed like it was a long season when they were pitching to me. But I my idea was to give a lot of souvenirs to the fans. And
52 of them.
No, it's 50. 50.
50.
50. Get it right.
So, it probably did feel like a short season coming off of 75 and 76, though.
Well, like I say, I say it's 52 free rides around the bases. I just had to learn how to get my home run trot together. One thing you don't want to trip, but you want to style going around the bases and be consistent when you like. Dave Parker had the best, but I couldn't copy his, so I had to come up with my own style.
Who has the best right now that you've seen?
The best right now, well, probably Ortiz with Boston. And Price does not like the way he goes around the bases. So he let him know one time he buried a ball right in his ribs. But I try not to irritate the pitchers. The guys like, many of you know Bob Gibson. You know, I try to get around the bases as fast as possible because I don't want to show him up. But other guys, well, one good story, pitcher for the Pirates, and I was being walked a lot, and so I decided to come up with some idea to irritate the pitcher, Jim Rooker for the Pirates. So I flipped the bat in the air after he walked me. So as I'm going down to first base, he said, don't you ever throw that bat again. And then I act tough. I said, well, throw the ball on the plate then. So we went to Pittsburgh, and he threw me a fastball. I didn't want his best pitch is a changeup. So he threw me a fastball, I let it go. And he threw me a changeup, hit a line drive, home run in the front row. And to this day, Manny St. Guillen said it broke the seat in left field, and I had to pay for it. I said, no, charge it to Jim Rooker. So, but after the inning was over, he said, nice hit. I said, you'll come out better by walking me. It was tough in those days.
It's a 77 season. You know, Marty says that. I looked it up. Well, I mean, not that it's that great a feat to look it up, but led the league in runs, 124.
Correct.
Home runs, 52.
He's 50. You got it. Almost.
RBI, 149. Slugging.
You got to put some emphasis on it. 149.
Nine.
Yeah.
It's not 150, but 149.
Okay.
Which is 149 more than I ever had. 631 slugging and a 101.3 OPS. All those led the National League, which is a pretty amazing season.
Did you mention... I don't think you mentioned total bases. Did you mention
the total bases was also on there as well? Yes, I did not mention it though. But you're right.
Don't slight me.
I didn't mean to slight you. Yes.
But the 149, would you fail to tell everybody? It's the highest any Reds player has accomplished. So I had to have the RBI single season record right now, right? Okay.
That's amazing.
I think it's pretty amazing to lead in RBI and runs. I mean, a lot of that helps when have 52 home.
You're scoring
home
yourself.
Runs.
You're knocking yourself in. Then you let somebody else drive you in, too. But I love driving myself in. You know, when people say a man is in scoring position at second and third, they're in scoring position when they're at first base, when I was up.
When you're George Foster.
No brag, this fact.
He is the best.
What else you got? Come on.
I didn't know you came into the league with the Giants. What was that like?
It started out that I was about 6'5". No, my dream was to play for the San Francisco Giants because I idolized Willie Mays. And so it happened I got a chance to play in the Giants organization from 68 to mid 71, May of 71, I was traded to the Reds. But I started out with the San Francisco Giants.
What was that like when you first met Willie Mays?
It was nerve-wracking. I didn't know what to say, and it was like nothing. I was trying to talk, but nothing was coming out of my mouth. So
I'm guessing that hasn't happened a lot.
Well, whoa. Who's talking to you? Well, that was the first and last time it did, so I started reading Webster Dictionary, and I had to come up with more words to say. So, and even in... I got Japanese words, Spanish words, so like hajime maste, or hola, como esta, things as such. So I'm starting to be more bilingual now.
Multilingual.
Polyglot. What's next? Josh, are you there?
You were Japanese spoken.
I know. You were telling us before we started about a story regarding Pete when you got to the Giants and how...
To the Reds. Traded from the Reds. Right. Giants to the Reds on May 29th, 1971 for Frank Duffy and Vern Geisert.
Geisert. It sound like a waterfall or something. Geisert.
What do you remember about that call that when you were told you were getting traded? Because you said growing up was your dream to play for the San Francisco Giants. You made it to San Francisco Giants, and then the San Francisco Giants say...
Well, at the time, I didn't realize that... Neither realized that there are other teams that are out there. And with the Giants, you got Mays, Bonds, and a guy named Ken Henderson. They played every day. And so they try to make me feel good by saying you're the fourth outfielder. But if those guys are playing 150 games a season, like I'm sitting back watching, and for a while I was Willie Mays' caddy. If the score's too big or if it's too cold out, Willie Mays say, well, send the kid out there. So I was his caddy. Well, that was fine. But... after getting traded, I didn't get a call. I was sitting on the bench, and I heard it on the radio that I was traded to the Reds. And here we are in first place. The Giants were in first place my first full year in the major league, and all I'm thinking about being in the World Series. Nope, you got traded to the Reds. There were 14 games in last place. So I went from 14 games up, 14 games down. But as it turned out, it was great for me because I got a chance to be in, of course, winning the World Series in 75, 76. I don't really want to mention the 72 World Series because we ended up losing that one. But everything, you know, turned out well for me getting traded to the Reds because the Giants did not repeat as a team until 1990.
Did you realize when you got there that, I mean, you were coming into a pretty tough spot, too. In Cincinnati, there were some crowded outfielders, crowded playing time there. You didn't immediately play every day. I think, was it 73? You were down in the minors a little bit more, 74?
You could have said I was demoted, but down in the minors, like saying you just sent out, you know.
No. I mean, you were
sent out to Siberia or someplace.
I'm sure it kind of felt like it.
Well, that again turned out great. I got a chance to play every day. And with the Reds, I was playing part-time, and it wasn't too much fun. I was pinch running or going in for defense, so I didn't get a chance to play that much. Even in the 72 World Series, I didn't really feel a part of it because I didn't get a chance to play. So going back to Indianapolis, I got a chance to really enjoy playing the game. Ken Griffey Sr., he taught me how to learn to play the game. I was too serious all the time. So you see Brandon Phillips now, he's having great time out there. He doesn't mind smiling when things are going well or going bad, but he's always having a good attitude. So I learned to not take it too seriously. So with going down to the minor leagues, got a chance to play every day, and then finally got a chance to be brought back up to the Reds and there to stay.
You were telling us, though, that when you got to the Reds that Willie called Pete on your behalf. What? Tell us about that phone call.
Well, I didn't know until later on. So at that time, there were veterans on other teams that wouldn't speak to you because you're a rookie. Veterans on your own team wouldn't speak to you. Guys like Gaylord Perry, Juan Marshall, those guys wouldn't speak to you. So you felt uncomfortable if you're playing and they're pitching. And if you make a mistake, you know, they're looking right at you. So Gaylord Perry, he would tell the manager, take that kid out of the lineup because he's going to cause me to lose a game. So I end up getting traded to the Reds. So now I'm walking down the tunnel, and Pete Rose was walking on the other side. He spoke to me, and I was like, who is he talking to? Couldn't be talking to me. I'm a rookie, and veteran players don't speak to rookies. But then and there, I realized that I belong. I felt I belonged to the team because it's like he was welcoming me to the team. But then I learned later on also Willie Mays had called over and told Pete to, you know, take care of the kid. I mean, that was heartwarming knowing that, you know, Willie said, take care of the kid. And when I hit 50 home runs that particular year, you know, I felt great because I got a chance to hit as many home runs as my idol Willie Mays had done. No crying.
That's awesome.
There's no crying in baseball, Josh. I'm not crying.
How did it feel when you left the Reds? You know, after leaving such a great team and great years here, you know.
You gonna make me cry. No, leaving the Reds, it was tough because I've spent 11 years in the organization, then it was like the people in Cincinnati, they're genuine. That when they say they're your friend, they're really your friend. And it was tough leaving friendship. So going to New York, it was much different. It was more business-like there compared to with the Reds. I mean, it's baseball and business, but in New York, you know, they expect you to get a hit every time at bat. If you don't, they're going to boo you. So we had a guy on the team named Mookie. I said, wow. Maybe I change my name to Buki or Mookie or Snooky. So if they boo me, I'm thinking they're calling me Snooky. But I remember I hit two grand slams in a week's time. And then the third time up, I popped up to the catcher and I got booed. And then the next time up, I got a base hit. I got booed because I didn't get the base hit the previous time up. So you can't win for losing there. But it was one of those situations that I just felt when they got Strawberry and got Gary Carter, I said, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to bat in front of those guys. I'm going to get a lot of pitches to hit. No, too fast, Mr. Foster. You're batting behind those guys. So I didn't have anybody behind me to protect me, so to speak. But I end up I think my best year home runs wise, I hit like 28 home runs and 90 RBIs. I thought it was superb considering the ball club. I'm driving myself in a lot of time. And then my man on second base, they're not gonna pitch to me that much. So I learned to, that's where I learned to golf, because they throw balls in the dirt, I would swing at it and get a base hit. They wouldn't throw me any pitches to hit.
It's funny you talk about this. I was thinking, when you came to Cincinnati, when did you realize that this was a special team, that this was a great team that you were joining? And then when did you see that starting taking shape with the Mets? Because the Mets in 85, you guys were in that drag-out pennant race with the Cardinals, and then they won out in 86 later.
Well, with the Reds, it started back before I got traded. I had come to Riverfront, and I said, maybe somebody heard me. I said, wow, this would be a great stadium to play in, because you had AstroTurf, a brand-new park, and the weather. I love the weather here compared to 30 or 40 degrees in San Francisco. So I said, I would love to play here. And then with the Reds, in 74, I got a chance to start playing on a part-time basis, and platoon, rather. And then finally, Sparky started putting me into the lineup on a regular basis. So he called me into the office. It was like a reverse psychology. I said, I'm going to give you a chance to lose this job. Like, instead of saying, I'm going to give you an opportunity to win it. So, but I wasn't really listening to him. I was excited about the fact of getting a chance to play every day. And we were playing against the Atlanta Braves. And I beat up on the Atlanta Braves. I remember one year we beat the Atlanta Braves 17 out of 18 times. And we were upset because we lost that one game. So, but the Atlanta Braves, you know, that you want some hits, call them up. You want hits, call the Cubs up. But back with the with the Mets, is that in 84, we started getting great talent, Strawberry, Dwight Gooden, of course, had gotten Hernandez from St. Louis. So the team started to come together. I told Keith that we got to get a big lead so that these young kids can start getting experience and confidence. So that's when the Mets started to play better, starting in 84.
Very good. I think that's pretty fascinating. Those are two just very distinct teams. I think of, you know, the Reds as kind of the team of the 70s, and then that mid-80s Mets team. You were pretty much the first piece of that,
right? Well, with the Reds, would say that you were part of the Big Red Machine. In the beginning, I wouldn't correct him, but now I correct him. I said I was the Big Red Machine. So, you know, at times you get tired of being modest, that you want to let people know, because you want to toot your own horn because somebody else is doing it. But I think the Reds were at 500. When I got into the lineup, and after that, we soared after that. And I'm not saying it was because of me, but maybe it was. But I know two things happened.
But that was when he moved Pete Rose to third base, when Sparky moved Pete Rose to third base.
I'm getting to that. That's my script there. So when Pete Rose moved, people say that Sparky asked Pete to move to third, but I threatened Pete. I said, you better move to third by sundown. So he's at third base by sundown.
I like how this story started with Pete taking you under his wing and ends with you saying, Pete, you better move to third base by sundown.
He was nice to me, and I was nice to him. I let him know that if you want to stay healthy, you better move to third base, because I got my guys, you know, out there. No, but Pete is a team player, and he of course, he moved from second base to the outfield, let Tommy Helms play. And then he moved, of course, from left field to third, let me play. So that was great, because it shows he's a team player. But I was the guy that really helped make that team, I guess, intimidating. Because you have a bench press, Foster, power hitters. And Morgan can hit for power, too. But we had speed, power, speed. And to this day, I'm wondering, why don't these general managers see that? And all you do is, you know, get some speed in the lineup, because speed's going to give you more fastballs to hit. And there were times that Joe Morgan, he was stealing a base, and the fastball sitting there, it's like, I like carrot cake, and it was like carrot cake right there. I'm not going to let it go. So I hit a home run, and I'm excited about it. I crossed the plate, and Joe said, why'd you swing at that? I said, well, it's gone now. I can't change it. But he wanted to steal the base. I said, Joe, you don't have to steal the base. I'll bring you in.
So, I mean, Willie Mays and Pete Rose, two people who sort of mentored you, it's pretty iconic names. What are some of the people that came to you for advice or that you kind of took under your wing later on in your career?
Guys I took under my wing at the time, well, like a Strawberry or Dwight Gooden, at the time you didn't know, but later on when they started telling stories about, well, Foster helped me or mentored me, but I knew that it's that same, I guess, analogy, being able to give back. I know when I came up, Bobby Bonds was instrumental also, because Bobby Bonds was the guy that introduced me to Willie Mays. So what Mays did for Bonds, Bonds was doing for me. And so I strive when guys say with the Mets, like a Strawberry and a Dwight Gooden, talking to them, and Griffey and I hit it off very well. Like I said earlier, we roomed together, so he had good speed, and I threatened him. I said, you got to score from first base. I don't care if it's a single or what. You got to score from first base. As you say, he's real fast. But having that speed there and having a guy like a Griffey who had that great, great desire to be a star player. So Griffey and I hit it out well. But guys like going back to Eric Davis or Gary Reed is the ones who know those guys. And even today, talking to some of the guys, trying to, like I was talking to Schumacher last night or Negron, letting them know what they're doing is good. But they're not really sure that they're doing well. But like I said, you got to know what you're doing. So when you're not doing it, you get back to what you're doing correctly.
How much do you watch the Reds now?
I watch them a lot because there's certain guys that I want to watch. Like Jay Bruce, I say to myself, I just wish I had an opportunity to go and work on his approach. Because every time he goes up there, he's trying to pull everything. And I'm saying, you don't have to try to pull the ball to hit home runs. But guys thinking that you had to pull the ball to hit home runs. Or it, like, even before he was hurt, Phillips, you know, he has a great swing when he's practicing. But once he started getting into the games, he changed his swing. But it's just watching certain things that not only the Reds do, but other players like Stanton with Miami. I love to watch him hit or Mike Trout for the Angels. Just look at the mechanics that they're utilizing when they're hitting. What are they doing when they have two strikes? And that's when you're able to hit the ball to the opposite field with two strikes, that you're showing that you're a great hitter or becoming a good hitter.
You're obviously very beloved by the Reds family, and I see you at many events. Is that something that you always knew when you left Cincinnati, that was Cincinnati kind of always going to be the team you look back on as like your home?
Well, like you said, that you know you can get to you know that they're true, they're great fans, and I've gone to different, need to say, in different ballparks, and since the Reds fans are the best fans of all. Because I've seen the Reds fans cheer an opposition if they make a good play. You go to other cities, you know, they don't do that. And you know you have that great support. But the players of the day don't really realize that the fans are like the 10th man on the field. And that they live and die, literally, if you win or lose. And they adopt you as another son because they want you to do well and they want the team to do well. But these players today, they're more so playing for themselves and maybe for the team, but more so for themselves. But they don't realize how much the fans are out there for them, not just to cheer. But when they're on the West Coast, they're listening to the game until it's over, watching the game until it's over. So, you talk about a fanatic, that's the description of the Reds fans, but they take it to heart.
How much has money changed that? Because, you know, back you still made a very good living when you were playing, but nothing like now. I mean, you were more closer in income to a regular fan back when you guys played than they are today. Today they're it's a totally different thing. They cannot relate to a regular person because of the money they're making. Whereas in your time it was you were a regular person.
Well, I blame it on the front office. It's something that they have, like the Cardinals. You know, they're guys who make a lot of money, but they make sure that they interact with the fans and letting them know that they're important. So it comes from the front office. I mean, day one, to letting them know you got to go out there and interact with the fans. You got to talk to the fans, sign autographs. Because when we're coming up, we would maybe half hour after we had taken batting practice, go sign autographs. And I don't think the players of the day do that. They're talking. When you talk about money, they're thinking that every autograph you're signing, oh, that's $20 I didn't get or $50 I didn't get. But that's not the important part, especially with kids. When kids want an autograph, give them that autograph because they idolize you. They want to be a next Votto, a next Phillips, a next Frazier. So it's important to take time with the kids.
Yeah, that's worth clapping for. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good segue to talk about your boot camp that you do every year. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how it came to be?
Well, a friend of ours, Paul Braunhaber, had gone over to Iraq. And before then, we had started just regular camp. But when he had come back, with honors, he had come back, and so he just started a boot camp because I look at it as teamwork. So we talk about the military side, the things that you have to do to be a team, because in the military, you really have to be a team because it's a matter of life and death. So in baseball, it's learning how to be a team, hitting the cutoff man or making a quality out or bunting the guy over, making a sacrifice. So with Paul, we wanted to have the military side and then the baseball side. But all in all, it's teaching life skills through baseball or through the Foster boot camp. And it's been very successful, but we focus a lot on the military kids. A lot of those military kids are neglected, I guess mainly because they don't want to be known. And some people or kids maybe get vicious because, you know, when we were growing up, we would tease one another, but it becomes very vicious in teasing because they would say, well, your dad or mom's not coming back because they got shot or something happened drastic to them. So they don't really want to be known, and so people won't harass them. So I just find that with having a lot of military kids or families there, it's like a reunion for them. So it's heartwarming to see that, and they're the best thus far we've seen. Being obedient, you know, when they say, yes, sir, like, where are you from? I haven't heard yes, sir, in such a long time. But it's just out of respect. So having the military kids involved, I mean, we still have other, say, inner city kids or other kids who want to be involved, but we really focus on the military kids to give them something. It's like an outlet to be able to have pleasure and joy.
And if people listening want to find out more about that, they can go to fosterbootcamp.com. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, and you do that once a year?
Right now, once a year. We want to expand, but thus far, we want to keep it going. We want to go to different cities or different states, but we want to grow it to maybe 50 to 100 kids before we expand to another venue. But it's been going well thus far, but we're striving to get that vehicle that will take us, that we can use, say, like a sponsor would take us yeah, to, if it's Indiana, or take us to Kentucky and give it.
So this is a fun fact. I was reading this in 1969, which is the year you debuted, on September 22nd, Willie Mays pinch hit for you, and that was his 600th home run.
That Willie Mays is always there, isn't he?
Did you tell him, did you say you're welcome? You let him have your bat?
Well, that was the first and last time I ever get into a huddle to celebrate or congratulate someone. That's when we use metal spikes. I almost got my big toe severed off because somebody stepped on my toe. So from then on, I wait till the guy gets into the dugout, I give him a high five. But when the manager said, Willie Mays is pinch hitting for you, he's like, what can I say? But go get him, Willie.
That's pretty
but
awesome.
But it becomes a trivia, is that who pinch hit for George Foster to hit his 600th home run? So I say I let him do it. It's your time, Willie. I feel it. Go ahead.
By all means.
Take it from here.
I'm going to ask you about the 1975 World Series, by many considered to be the greatest World Series ever played. I was actually today, because of this, I was watching Game 6. And bases loaded, no outs, bottom of the ninth at Fenway Park.
Yes.
Sparky actually
doo-doo
walked the bases loaded.
Doo-doo, doo-doo.
He walked, it was Yastrzemski to get to Fred Lynn.
Yep.
Fred Lynn, who's was MVP and Rookie of the Year that year, with Game 6 of the World Series on the line, and he swings at the first pitch in that little corner in left field at Fenway Park, foul territory.
Yeah, about 300 feet away, right?
Yeah.
Way back.
And take me through that play when you see, I mean, before the play, it looked like you guys were shaded over towards left with McElhaney on the mound, the left-hander,
right,
against the left-handed Lynn.
Well, it started back in Dominican Republic. I'm playing right field, one out, and bases loaded, and a ball is hit down the right field foul line. I could have caught it, but I'm going away from home plate, so I let it drop. So I got a cascade of boos because I let it drop. Then it's like, please, please hit a ground ball. So the next pitch was a ground ball, and the guy got a double play. Now I become a hero. But I felt that if even if the ball's in foul territory, if I'm going towards my target, I go to catch it. But if I'm going away from it, let it go. So with Fred Lynn and McElhaney confronting one another, I'm moving towards the line somewhat. So Fred's, I didn't want him to get another opportunity. So
right.
I went over, and at that time I was, well, the lady had some popcorn, so I was hungry that night because it was a long game. So I mainly went over to get some, see if she, it was buttered popcorn or not. But it, since it wasn't, so I decided to catch the ball. It was a brand new ball, and to this day I wish I had thrown it in the air because it got grass stains on it when it hit the grass. But Johnny was one of the great, well, the greatest catcher, being able to catch it instead of with both hands, with one hand, and being able to tag Denny Doyle out. But you anticipate plays as such, being prepared, and you know the bases loaded, Fred Lynn's up. The game was on the line, but yet we were 3-2 up on
right,
them.
Right, you were up a game.
Even if we lose the game, there's going to be a game 7, as it turned out to be. But you got to anticipate what's going to transpire, so when it happens, you're ready for it.
Did you think, okay, we got this now?
Not really. It's not really sure because we care, but we didn't care in a sense because we were running out of pitching. We didn't want to get into our starting pitching. And one thing that Sparky had done, and I don't know if the Darren Johnson, those guys know to this day, we only had 9 pitchers, and we had Clay Kirby who was hurt. So Sparky had Clay Kirby to get up and throw. So now they're thinking that we have a right-hander throwing. But his arm was broke, so he couldn't come into the game. So that's smart strategy. Yes, Grasshopper, you got to do that. So, but at that time, we still felt well, we had an opportunity, but it wasn't. When Carlson Fisk hit the home run, it was like a relief. Oh, the game's over, get prepared for the next game. Because it was really becoming draining because there were a lot of rainout game. So we felt confident we would win the next game.
Yeah, I think there's a story that Pete told somebody like during the game how what a great game this was. Was that just kind of the feeling?
That's Pete for you. He's a cheerleader out there, and he would tell you, "Come on, go out there and get 4 or 5 hits." One is that he's encouraging you to do it, and another is he's driving him in so he has a chance to lead the league in runs. So it all works for the benefit of the team.
That lineup, you guys are called the Great Eight.
But
you look at it, and it's not just greatness in the lineup. That was a great defensive team as well.
We won every award except a Cy Young Award. We had Gold Glove, MVP, stolen base. Well, I don't know if we won a stolen base, but we could have. But we were up there. And even the pitching had an adequate ERA. I think it was like 3.2 or something as such. But we could do everything. We could beat you with the glove, beat you with our legs, beat you with the bat. And now and then with pitching, with Billingham and Gullett out there. So we had all we need, but the main thing, that strong desire, that intangible, strong desire and feeling that we're the best out there. You would see guys, well, a story with San Diego, Gaylord Perry's with San Diego. And when we started taking batting practice, he tried to herd all his pitchers, so don't watch him hit. Do not watch him hit. They're like, why? And they saw us start launching the ball into the bleachers, and they're like, wow, I don't want to pitch today. I think my arm is sore. I don't want to pitch. I don't want to give up a home run. So we intimidated. We saw that they were watching and say, okay, let's intimidate these kids. So, but those are things that we could do. And then Gaylord Perry, I thought he was greeting us, you know, welcome to San Diego. But he was trying to see where we're hitting the ball. In batting practice, you can tell where a guy likes to hit the ball. So I started hitting everything in the right field. So what is he thinking? That I'm not getting around on the pitch that's inside. So I know the first pitch, he's going to throw me inside. So he did. I trusted, and I hit a home run. So I'm running around
so
the bases.
Awesome.
Well, I'm running around the bases, patting myself on the back. Man, you're smart. You know. You're so erudite. You know.
That's the thing about 76. With Morgan, the MVP, you came in second. And
oh, why do you want to bring
Rose,
that up?
Just, but I'm just saying.
You had to say is Morgan won the MVP.
That team had 4 out of the top 10 vote getters for the MVP. Has that ever been done any other year?
But nobody remembers Sackett except you.
8 years from 1970 to 1977, 6 of the MVPs were won by Reds.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Just you look up and down the lineup. You know, you had Bench, Rose, Morgan. And yourself all win MVPs.
Yeah, something that to strive for. Because during the season, I don't try to drive in more runs than a Bench or Perez. But I felt if I'm close, I had a great year. And because those guys, they go, especially Tony Perez. You know, he's going to average 90 plus RBIs a season. So I want to be consistent like that. Being able to, if he didn't do it, he knowing that I will do it. So I remember in Chicago. I was batting, I think, fifth or sixth, or probably fifth, and a man on first and second, first base is open. So the manager did this. So he walked Tony Perez. And I'm more like telling him before I get up there, like, thank you. You know, thanks for the 4 RBIs that I'm going to get it. So Bruce Sutter came in. He threw 9 pitches, 8 pitches to warm up, and the first pitch to me. Straightaway center, grand slam. So I'm going around third base, giving my third base coach high five, and then pointing to the manager, good job, good job. He didn't like that.
What about the 1977 World Series, or 76 World Series, sorry.
Oh, that one, it was like a cakewalk, you know.
It's amazing after the 75, which was 4-3 and it's tough. Was there something that you guys wanted to prove because it was
well,
so tough?
Well, prove to ourselves, because we thought after Jim Rice got hurt that we're going to beat the Red Sox like we beat the Yankees. But I think it brought them more together as a team when Rice was hurt. So when they beat us, I think it was 7-0 the first game. It was like, whoa, they don't respect us. We don't Big Red Machine, they don't really care. So we said, we got to go out there and battle now. And we end up winning, I think, the second game, a close ball game. I think all 5 games were settled by 1 run difference. And so we knew that they were in for a battle against them. So, but with the Yankees, we went with the attitude that we're going to have both barrels firing. And, you know, we don't no mercy. And winning 4 straight, as it turned out, was great. We weren't looking to win 4 straight. But as it turned out, we were able to dominate the New York Yankees. How about that?
That's awesome.
Very good. That's kind of a natural spot.
Yeah. So what we'll do right now is we're going to take a quick break, let the folks that showed up tonight get a refill or use the facilities. We're going to come back. We'll take some questions from the folks in the room. Then we'll say goodbye to everyone listening at home and then take a couple more questions to reward those who did show up. Before we take this break, reminder, you can follow everyone up here on Twitter. At C Trent, at Josh Sneed, at GFOS15, GFOS15, and be sure to follow at ENQ Sports for all of your CDOT and other podcast needs. So we'll be right back. This is the CDOT Show live from Motor Pub in downtown Cincinnati.
Give it up.
Okay, terrific. Welcome back. Welcome back to the CDOT Show, presented by Inquirer Sports. I am your host, Josh Sneed, joined by co-host Trent Rosecrans and our special guest this episode.
Special? What do you mean by special?
The second-place finisher in the MVP votes in 1976. George Foster is here, ladies and gentlemen.
When we come back, Josh is like, welcome back. You don't be excited. Welcome back.
6th place finisher in 1978.
Okay, we're going to turn the show over to our in-house audience. Please state your name and ask your question to George Foster. We'll take a couple, and then we'll shut the mics off and then have a nice little fun conversation off the air.
And your social encourage those at home
to, real shit.
To come down here next time. Yes, sir.
Hi, guys. I'm Josh, as you know. So, George, I got a question for you regarding coaching type stuff. I know you've mentioned several times that you see things in guys' swings that you feel like you could correct and all that stuff. Have the Reds ever approached you about that, or is that something that you would be willing to do, or would you like to do?
Oh, I would love to do that. I've express mail, I voicemail, hand carried. I don't know what else I need to do to let them know that I'm interested, but I just feel that they're doing the fans an injustice. Not if they want to win, get somebody who has won and know how to win. And I just see these certain guys, if it's a Schumacher or a Jay Bruce or a Lutz, things that I can help them to do to become a better hitter is going to help the team. I mean, they're like, I think, 5 games out and like 45 or so games left. So now it's very important that they win these games and not win 1 or 2 and then lose 5 or 6. But these guys are very instrumental in that batting in the batting order, especially in Jay Bruce's case. We get him hot, it's going to help that ball club win. So I would look forward to them giving me an opportunity to work with these guys. And I'll guarantee you that I would be able to help them and let them know that the numbers that I have in the media guides, they're not fabricated. They're actually true.
I want to follow up on something you just said. They're 5 games out, 45 games left to play. What's going through a player's mind right now? Are they still 100% in, thinking that they can do it when it feels like everybody else is kind of given up on them?
Well, it's more thinking because they don't have that to that level of knowing, because you have a Mesoraco who this is his first full year, and you have part-time players. Frazier's having an outstanding year, but he's getting fatigued, so you need somebody else to lead them. So these guys, they got to start playing as a team. If the pitcher's bunting somebody over or getting a guy over with no outs, man on second, throwing to the right base, getting that fly ball with a man at third base, become a team player. These small things make a big difference in the ball game. So you take a lot of pressure off of if it's a Jay Bruce, if it's a Frazier, that he doesn't have to hit a home run to drive in the run. So you got to start playing it as a team and do the small things.
But as a player, you think they're still, we can do this?
I don't think, they may say it, but I don't think they feel it deep down inside, because they don't really have the confidence. They don't believe in one another, and some of them don't believe in themselves they can do it. They still have that internal battle. You see a Ludwig up there, he's like, I hit this ball 2 years ago. Why am I not hitting it now? So he's battling a battle within himself instead of having the confidence, okay, don't swing at a ball that I'm not able to hit. Get a pitch I can handle. But a lot of them don't want to get deep in the count because they don't have the confidence they can hit with 2 strikes.
Good. All right.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm Dale. And I know you fear no man, but...
No man.
But if you had to choose one pitcher that you would never want to face, who would it be?
I never thought of that. I was no intimidation. Being in from California, anybody know about Watts? That's a tough area to be. It's like being in New York, Central Park. Because in Central Park, if you're walking through the park, they would stop you and ask you if you have a gun. Because if you don't, they'll give you a gun. Because they said, don't go through here defenseless. But if a right-handed Chapman, I probably would fear. But left-handed, not so much, but a right-handed Chapman. But J.R. Richards, going back, when I faced him in the Dominican Republic, the lighting wasn't that good. All you heard was the ball hitting the catcher's mitt, asking the umpire, was it a strike? I didn't see it. But J.R. Richards, probably the guy that you would fear when you don't have good lighting.
I'd fear him anytime. Oof. Dusty used to always talk about facing J.R. Richard.
Dusty?
Trent thrives in bad lighting.
He's not even in our class, Dusty. He was with the Dodgers, Dusty Baker. We beat on those Dodgers.
1977.
Why are you bringing up Dusty Baker? It wasn't Dusty. And I said, I'll see you outside later. My guys are waiting on you.
So I never got to experience you as a player. I was too young. My first, you know, kind of interaction or knowing of you was like through baseball cards. And the only thing I have to ask was, what happened to the sideburns?
Oh, you're talking about the baseball card, the sideburns. Well, I was in a hurry today, and I forgot. I got them all prepared, and I left them at home. No, I tried to grow them back, but they came back in the gray colors. So that was the reason I cut them off, so it'd be more controversial. If I had them, they'd like, yeah, nice sideburns. I don't have them. Where are they? But I call them power burns. But with the Reds, you weren't allowed to have facial hair. But I said, Sparky, what are you gonna do? You gonna play me or sit me? If you don't play me, you're not gonna win. You're not gonna win. You may lose your job. He said, I'm gonna tell your mama. Oh, well, my mama liked him too. So I guess I was the first one with the power burns, and everybody else tried to emulate. You know, but they never could. They couldn't copy.
That's the best.
Hi, my name is Richard.
Hi, Richard.
I think my favorite George Foster moment of all time is the 1972 NLCS, ninth inning. Benches just hit the home run.
Yeah.
Riverfront Stadium is pandemonium. I'm jumping up. I'm 17 years old. I'm jumping up and down on my couch like Tom Cruise on Oprah.
17 years old, jumping up on the couch?
Yep.
Okay.
I was a young baseball fan. I was going crazy. And before I knew it, you were standing on third base with the winning run. And before any of us knew it, that was Roberto Clemente's last game.
Yeah.
And that moment was so packed with history. And I'm just wondering what it was like for you standing on third base. You'd only been with the Reds a year. And suddenly, what was it like the moment before and the moment after Bob Moose uncorked that wild pitch and you saw it get past Manny Sanguin? What was going through your mind?
Well, I had pinch run for Tony Perez at the time, and the basics that you teach when you're at third base, making sure that you watch the ball, you know, across home plate, but look down just in case it's going to be a pass ball wild pitch. And always stay, when you're leading off, stay in foul territory. Why? Because if the guy hits it and hits you, you're not out. You may be knocked out, but you're not out. So always make sure that you're looking at the pitch. And so as I saw it bounced in the dirt, there was an opportunity to score. But really, the real story is that it was so cold out there, I just trying to find a way to get in the dugout to warm up. And those guys were grabbing me. I'm just glad I didn't have my wallet because some of those guys may pickpocket me at the same time. But I didn't really realize the importance of it until later on, because I would go to restaurants, and the first time I go there is not that many people. Next time it was a packed house. They're like, why are these people here? And little did I know that they were like, George Foster, he comes here and eat breakfast. And they started giving me free food, and I felt guilty. You know, I wanted to order like two waffles and two omelets, but I said, no, they're giving this to me free, so I don't want to be greedy, but not knowing that they're making more money off me because people are coming in and watching. So the marketing, I didn't know about marketing at that particular time, but it was exciting to score the winning run, and for the next couple of years, when the Reds would come on, you see me scoring. I got tired of running, but you know, seeing me score at that particular time, so it was that the intro, the big red machine will come into play. But it was exciting to score that winning run, and because at that time it was 2-2, and the Pirates were up when Johnny Bench hit that home run, and we thought we were going to lose. As it turned out, we were the victors.
I just one more thing. I just remember you running home and your strides, your whole body emanated such joy. And I'll never forget that.
I was like a gazelle.
Yeah.
All right, this will be our
snort.
It was a snort. There was a snort in the room. This will be our last question, and then we'll.
It better be good.
Turn the recording devices off and get into the good stuff.
So you show up opening day in '77. did anything feel different? Was it something you, obviously you're confident, were you expecting to win the MVP, or did you kind of just wake up in August and you're like, damn, I'm having a good year?
No, 76 really taught me, because I thought I had a chance to win the MVP, and then after I didn't, I said, I want to make sure I have a great year and be more consistent in 77. I wanted to play as many games as possible and being consistent, productively consistent. So after that year, I didn't really care if they voted me the MVP or not. I just want to make sure that I put a lot of pressure on them saying, okay, because they seldom have a guy who wasn't on the winning team to win the MVP. So as it turned out, I had, you know, we're leading the league in RBIs, home runs, total bases, runs scored, slugging percentage. So it's like they had to vote for me.
OPS.
So OPS.
That wasn't big at the time, but.
POS, UPS, USPS. Oh, okay. And but I just felt that year I just want to go out there and try to dominate and see how good I could be and being consistent. And I had taken martial arts that year. I was very strong. I was like grasshopper. So I was so agile. I was like I can, like Spider-Man, no matter what position I need to be in, I was there. But I was played 159 games that year, and so I was very productively consistent. But when I had 49 home runs with 10 games to go, I was like, oh no, if I end up the season with only 49 home runs, it's a failure.
Really? So,
but ironically, we do with Major League Baseball alumni, we do a lot of clinics for kids. So I was in Chicago area, and this guy, Buzz Capra, the guy I hit my 50th home run against, he came up to me and said, you remember me, right? And I said, well, I'm not sure. And I saw his name. Oh, yeah, you're my 50th, man. You're my 50th. And then I look. I have a list of the guys I hit the home runs against. I said, I wish I had this. I got 3 home runs that year against Buzz, but I think he only remembers one. Pitchers, you know, have a short memory. But I said, maybe I can get everybody who is on that list to sign it. But I said, some of the guys had to go into a seance to be able to sign. They're no longer with us. But that year, I just wanted to be very productive and then make the own. If the voters didn't vote for me, then there was going to be an outrage, I guess. So winning it was great, but after that, I didn't do it in 76. I just felt I more so maybe sabotaged my own year in 76, not being consistent in September.
That's awesome.
That's my story.
It's a great story, and I think this is where we're going to say goodbye to those listening.
Don't say goodbye.
We're gonna keep hanging out here, but we gotta say goodbye to those listening at home.
Oh, the listeners,
and in their cars and what have you. So to sort of wrap things up here. Yeah, go for it.
I'm George Foster. I'm here to say.
What are you here to say?
My favorite one is up the middle, say goodbye, another Foster RBI.
I like that.
Perfect.
There you go.
All right. Well, thanks of you to those who are listening at home. A reminder, you can hear all the episodes of the CDOT show by subscribing to the podcast in iTunes. You can also get to them on Cincinnati.com. Also, a reminder about my new series on Cincinnati.com called The Drive with Josh Sneed. Episodes 1 with Todd Frazier and episode 2 with Devin Mesoraco are now available for your viewing pleasure. Also, if you would like to be part of our CDOT audience, please come out to the next time we have a show, which will be on September 22nd. Come down here to the wonderful Motor Pub in downtown Cincinnati, who always does a great job of hosting us. And can we give them a round of applause real quick?
Yeah, Motor Pub. Give it up.
Don't forget to follow George on Foster. He is at GFOS15, GFOS15.
It's Jodge. It's not George, it's Jodge. Jodge. I just changed it.
Jodge?
Jodge.
And his
Jodge, Jodge Foster.
Jodge Foster.
And it's Fitty.
I got the Fitty part right. So at GFOS15, you can follow Trent at CTrent. I am at Josh Sneed. And, of course, follow at ENQ Sports for all sorts of good, fun stuff. And if you would like to find out more information about George's boot camp, check out fosterbootcamp.com and support that. It's a very awesome cause. Folks, one more time for nothing short of a Reds legend, Hoo-ah. George Foster.
Yep.
Happy to call you a friend, sir. Thank you for being with us here. And thank you for being with us or listening to us. On behalf of my co-host, Trent Rosecrans, I am your host, Josh Sneed, saying thank you for tuning in to CDOT. We'll see you next time.
Yep.
All right, I want to ask you a question.